Hi everyone, this is Catherine and welcome to the First Times Summer Series in which we are revisiting some of our most popular and favourite episodes. As you'll already know if you've listened to the Season 6 finale, Kate and I are taking a break from the First Time in its current format in 2024. But don't delete the feed just yet. I will be back in March with something new and slightly different. It'll still feature interviews with writers, but there'll be other creatives, comedians and entrepreneurs involved as well. One last thing before we get into this particular interview. To celebrate 6 seasons of the podcast and to kick off the coach salting work I'm doing for writers this year, I'm posting a series about what I've learned on the podcast, particularly about interviewing and being interviewed these past few years on Instagram. You can check it out at Catherine Collette Writer. I'll put a link in the show notes. This is the First Time podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. R.A. Spratt is a best-selling author, television writer, and podcast host. She's known for the shockingly good stories, Friday Barnes, The Pesky Kids, and Nanny Piggins series of books. R.A. Spratt has written for dozens of different television shows. In recent years, she has specialised mainly in children's animation, but she also has extensive experience writing jokes, sketch comedy, and political satire. Her podcast, Bedtime Stories with R.A. Spratt, was launched in February 2020 and has a huge following from around the world. In fact, I saw on Instagram it had 1.3 million downloads in 2022 alone, making it in the top 5% of Apple podcasts, if you are interested. R.A. Spratt lives in Barrel in Australia with her husband and 2 daughters. She's currently obsessed with CrossFit and, according to her Instagram, has been the fittest children's author on earth for 2 years in a row.
Three. because we've just finished the CrossFit Open, and it's a bit of a cheat because there's nobody else who goes in the children's author category.
I did suspect.
Yeah.
I had because some suspicions.
It's a big competition between firefighters and police officers and teachers and nurses. There's heaps of people do it in those fields. And there's a few authors, there's a dozen or so authors. But I can't even claim the best author because there's a lady in America who, this is a bit grim, she was attacked by a serial killer and she survived and she wrote a book and she's very fit now and she is fitter than me.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's
terrible. So many layers to that story.
I know. And she's 10 years younger than me, so I feel kind of harsh because, yes, she's been through a terrible ordeal, but she's only written one book and she's 10 years younger than me and she's stolen my title of the world's fittest author. So I'm only the world's fittest children's author.
Yeah, you need to start reducing the category size, don't you?
Yeah, and AJ Betts has pointed out to me that if we got on bicycles, she could kick my butt. And there's a couple of other authors, because the whole thing with CrossFit is you're not good at any one thing. You just can do a whole bunch of things. So there's lots of children's authors who are like, be good at running or good at cycling. And Felice Arena is really good at swimming. David Walliams is really good at swimming. So they could all beat me in their individual fields. But when it comes to doing a little bit of everything, I can take them out.
I love it. Watch this face. Now, this show is called The First Time Podcast. As the name suggests, we are very interested in how people's writing life begins. So in that vein, have you always been a writer?
Since I was at university, this is the only job I've had. So I'm 47 now and I left university at 22. So 25 years, I have not had a proper job. So when I was at uni, I worked briefly as a secretary and as a technical assistant with a pharmaceutical services company. So, I'm a writer. I've been a writer for ages.
And I understand your first job as a writer was in TV.
Yes. Good News Week. I wrote jokes for them. So I didn't really intend to become a writer. I wanted to be an assistant director because I like the idea of working in a crew and doing all the behind the camera stuff. But when I got to Good News Week to do my internship, the assistant director wasn't there that day. So they put me in with the writers, and it turns out I can write jokes, and it turns out not many people can. And so they gave me a job at the end of my internship, and I ended up staying for 3 years. And from there on, just one job led to another.
Do you remember the first joke that made it onto a TV show?
It was back when I do, but it won't be funny now. So I'm not going to say exactly what the joke was, because it requires so much context. But just to give you an idea of how long ago in history this was, it was not long after Princess Diana had passed away. So I don't know that joke got in the first week, maybe it was the second week, but I had a joke because Rupert Murdoch, there's so much explanation for this joke. Rupert Murdoch had made some comment because there was an inquiry into, like, should they have laws stopping paparazzi from chasing people? And he said it would just be another privilege for the privileged. That was his quote. And I had a joke something on the lines of, yes, I can just imagine Princess Diana as she was dying in the back of the car with her lover beside her who was already dead. She thought to herself, gee, I feel so privileged. So it's something like that.
Ooh, I
but
like
a lot
it.
Better worded, so that it was actually funny, and it was like having a dig at Rupert Murdoch. And then I had another one where I can't remember, but this is how black it was. You see, I was not a children's writer then, but it was about a politician. I shouldn't say what it was about, but it was a very black joke about a Labour politician who had personal misfortune. I was only 22 at the time and not as morally sewn up as I am now. So, yeah, anyway, that's the type of thing we were doing back then. It was like, you got to think, it was kind of a golden age for comedy. It was like the first time round Pauline Hanson was about, Bill Clinton with all the Monica Lewinsky stuff. That happened while I was at Good News Week. I still remember that. That was a golden day where they brought us into the office, because normally we split up who was going to write what. But the day we found out about the blue dress, the head writer brought us all in. He said, it would be unfair of me to prevent any of you from writing on this wonderful topic of comedy about the blue dress and the stain and everything. So there was a lot going on back then.
That's fascinating. I have this vision of TV as distinct from book writing as being such a collaborative thing. Isn't it? No. Right. It's not a team sport.
It is. Like, we were in, because it was pre-internet as well. Like, the internet had been invented, but we weren't really using it at that stage. So we would all still go into an office, and it was probably about the same size as the room I'm in now. And there was about four or five of us, but we would sit in the room, and we had a desk all around the walls, and we would sit and we would have our backs to each other, and we would write in complete silence. And like, we'd have about four topics a day you had to write on, and you'd write about 10 or 12 jokes on each topic. So you'd write a topic for about an hour to an hour and a half, and then you'd hand it in, physically hand in your jokes, a printout, and then I'd go get a coffee, and then you do it again and then you have lunch, and then you do it again, and maybe you go home, or maybe you do another one. But you didn't actually talk to anybody else about what you were writing. So one day after 2 years, this was how we worked, the group that worked at Good News Week. And it was kind of competitive too, because some people would get things in and some people wouldn't. And you sit in the meeting, you'd stew, and you're like, my joke was better than yours. So it wasn't really the most pleasant, warm feeling. But one day I went to Hong Kong for my brother's graduation from university. And when I came back, they'd hired two new writers. And I was the senior person in the writer's room, even though I wasn't the oldest. I was like half the age of everyone else, but they didn't have great social skills. So I was notionally in charge, like below the head writer, that was me. So when he wasn't there, I was in charge. So I came into the office, and there's two new writers that started the day before. And the oldest writer in the room, he came up to me, and he was like in his mid-40s, but he was like shaking with anxiety. And I'm like, and he came up to me, which is unusual, because obviously he doesn't want to speak to women. That would be awful. So he comes up to me, he's like, and I'm like, what's wrong, Steve? And he's like, there are two new writers in the writers' room. And I'm like, yeah, I know there's two new writers. And I'm like, they're talking to each other in the writers' room. They're talking out loud. And I'm like, oh, Steve. And he's like, you've got to put a stop to it. And like, Steve, we thought he was going to explode at any point and, you know, go postal on us all. So I was like, okay, I will put a stop to it. So I went up to these writers and I said, there's no talking in the writers' room. If you're going to talk,
so weird.
You have to leave. And this was the first conversation I ever had with my husband. So one of the writers I threw out of the room that day, I'm now married to, he's now working down the corridor on a play. So 24 years later, that was like, he looked up into my eyes as I told him to get out. And fell in love.
What a wonderful meet cute.
Yes.
Wow. Well,
downhill ever since.
That really was the opposite of my vision of TV.
Oh, no, it's just horrible. Everyone in TV is really horrible. It's terrible. Terrible, terrible people. Publishing is much nicer.
So at what point did you realise that and start to write books?
After Good News Week, I went to Backburner and Life Support, and my agent got me work on a TV show called.
Sorry, Bambaloo. Did you say you were on Life Support?
Oh yeah, I was the main writer on Life Support. Especially
sorry, I thought you were
year.
Physically on Life Support.
No,
okay,
no.
Sorry.
It's a TV show. Gosh, don't you know your Australian TV history? It was like a parody lifestyle show. But it spawned like Brendan Cowell and Abby right. Cornish, like people, yeah. It was really big. I'm amazed you're not familiar with work and not quoting it back to me right now. but I also, my agent got me a job on a kids TV show called Bambaloo, which was a puppet show with Jim Henson puppets. So they were shipping the amazing. Puppets out from the Jim Henson workshop in New York. And Jim Henson workshop is actually based in London, even though the puppets are physically made in New York because that's where Sesame Street is. So the scripts were being edited in London. So that was really exciting. Like I'd never worked in children's before. And so they're having these beautiful puppets come from New York and your work is being edited in London. So it was weird. You'd finish at like 5 PM and send your script off and go to bed. And then you wake up at 9 and someone had worked on it all through the night in London and given you notes back. So that was cool. And I wrote a lot of episodes for that show. So like about 20 or something. So that's really where I learned to write for kids. But it was very frustrating because I come from all these adult shows where you're just trying to be funny and entertaining all the time. And I just couldn't get over how in children's television, that is not the focus at all. It's all about meeting the standards, the broadcaster standards, and trying to get into as many markets as possible. So you have all these childhood advisors who are going through every script and just sucking all the fun out. Like they say, you can't use this word, you can't use that word, you can't show this, you can't show that. So, so I just thought, this is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. I love television. I didn't think we were making television that kids would love. So I just thought, I want to write something where it's just fun and full of energy and challenging and exploding with ideas. So I came up with the idea of Nanny Piggins and I pitched it to the production company I was working for. And they're like, this is a great idea. This is a great character. Like the setup, because it was set up like a sitcom where you've got a location and then you've got all the circus people coming in. They're like, oh, this is a great concept. But the first thing we'll have to do is we have to make the dad nicer. We have to make Nanny Piggins behave better. And we have to make all their actions have consequences. And you've got to cut out all the cake and the chocolate and all that stuff. And I just thought, no, that's the whole point, is to have all those things and to deal with them in some sort of fashion that is resembling honesty. So I had this idea that if I wrote it up as a book, I still wanted to do TV. So I thought I'd write it up as a book. Everyone will fall in love with it. It'll be a huge, huge hit. And then they'll make a TV adaptation and they won't be able to change anything. All the fans will like stone their offices. So that was my plan. The only thing that hasn't happened so far is it hasn't actually circled back and become a TV show. It's just become a whole phenomenon.
It is a very, my kids are obsessed with Nanny Piggins.
She's a genius. She's brilliant.
She is a genius. But I think as well that there is such a Roald Dahl quality to your work. And it is in this narrator who tells you about the world and tells you about people and can be kind of delightfully judgmental at times or not 100% correct.
It's weird because I go to schools and librarians, are you like a librarian at any stage in your past? Because librarians, they love their rules and they love things to be ticked and boxes and be filled. And I've had, like, a lot of librarians are super, super cool, but sometimes I'll go to a school visit and the librarian will introduce me and they'll say, Nanny Piggins is so naughty. And it just like something snaps in my head. And it's like, I turn into Nanny Piggins on the inside. It's like, she's not naughty. She has a very, very strong moral compass. It's just different to our own. And I've actually been thinking about it a lot lately because I've been thinking about, I don't want to get into a specific issue, but the way people use wokeism to like criticize and cancel other people. And, you know, oftentimes perfectly validly so, but it's like, I think it's a problem where in our society, like we know racism is wrong and sexism is wrong and being other things that they're wrong. But we think if we tick off those boxes, then we're right. And therefore then we can be mean. But it's like, if you just like Nanny Piggins sees it in more simple terms of like, I'm trying to not use this word, but just don't be mean to anyone. Like give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Try and be empathetic to everyone because otherwise you use your technical correctness to justify you then behaving despicably. I mean, so many people justify behaving despicably in in terms of enforcing rules. And it's like, well, that's so Orwellian. Like, rules can sometimes be wrong, and sometimes people can use very good rules, but for bad purposes. So I think that's where Nanny Pickens is so brilliant, is like, yes, she subverts it and she does things she shouldn't do, but she always does them with the best intentions. She loves the children and she is always fighting against injustice. And I mean, like, she does bully the poor headmaster, but he totally deserves it.
And Nanny Ann, I just like her critique of Nanny Ann.
But it's funny because she does have a moments where she sort of comes back and you get sort of a slightly sympathetic point, like when they did the Steel Chef, and you get this image at the end where Nanny Ann finally gets the trophy because she teams up with Nanny Pickens. She realizes that teaming up with Nanny Pickens is the way to win this cooking trophy. And it's just so hard for her to work with Nanny Pickens. But in the end, they win it because she's working with Nanny Pickens. And Nanny Pickens, I think, I can't even remember exactly what I wrote, but I think Nanny Pickens lets her keep the trophy. And Nanny Ann is so pleased. And she says something about her mother, and like, now her mother will have to finally admit that she can cook or something. And you think, oh yeah, of course, because Nanny Ann is yeah, like such a repellent person, but something in her past has made her be like that. And so you do get flashes of, Nanny Pickens does have some flashes of empathy with Nanny Ann about, she must have had a bad life for her to end up this way.
She's an extremely endearing character. Yeah. One of the things that you said in an interview about Nanny Pickens is that you were very methodical in coming up with the concept, and that it was like creating a Venn diagram. And so you gathered all these exciting concepts from circus to cake to chocolate to cannons, acrobatics, and you worked in the area that they overlap. I think this is so fascinating. Having all these fun and exciting things, it doesn't necessarily mean the work is going to be funny. So how do you... But it is funny. How do you balance this kind of wackiness with ensuring something is funny overall and just doesn't become a collection of bizarre isms?
Oh, well, the thing when you're a comedy writer is it's really hard not to write comedy. So things I write always end up being comedy. Like, people say Friday Barnes is very funny, and I don't write it intended to be funny. The thing is, you never focus on, like, I never focus on trying to be, I don't know, it's hard to say how you do it, but she takes it very seriously and you have to take it seriously. And also, some of the funniest stories are not the things that are wacky. Like, you're not like, how can I bring wacky ideas in? I set up all those wacky things where you've got the circus and you've got the brother who's the bear who lives in the garden, and I set them all up so that there was loads of potential for more stories, so that I would never run out of ideas. But some of the best stories are really simple, like when, you know, one of the first stories is Mr. Green gives her $500 to buy school uniforms, and she spends all the money at a fun park, and then they have to make uniforms, which is like a really kind of simple idea. Like, they have no uniforms, they have to get uniforms, and they have these really weirdly made uniforms. And it's all this opportunity to talk about how ugly uniforms are. It's like, you know, why would you wear a gray shirt with gray pants? That's so ugly. And why are you wearing tartan? Are you Scottish? And all these things you don't even think about that you take for granted about school uniforms, you get to discuss all of that. And so, yeah, so having all those extreme ideas is more about, like, in television, you talk about a sitcom, you know, situation comedy. It's more about setting yourself up so that you've got, you know, fuel to keep putting in the engine to keep it going. That the individual stories, you just need it to be something that they care about passionately. Like, for a kid to go to school wearing the wrong uniform, that is so, like, it like makes them feel so sick with anxiety if they're an anxious kid. The idea of turning up and not having their school dress, or there's been something wrong with their school uniform, for a kid, that's like one of their great fears. So you can have something quite simple and it really drives the story, and then the comedy will just come out of everywhere.
I love that. I want to talk again about this, what sometimes reads as a very pragmatic approach to writing that I think you have, or perhaps to setting and character choices, because often writers are very romantic about how they talk and the act of writing.
Yes.
You were asked in an interview about what encouraged you to write the Friday Barnes series, which is sort of Sherlock Holmes style detective story. And you said money. I did market research. Mystery books are one of the strongest selling genres. Plus, I wanted to write a page turner with cliffhangers, and a mystery is the best way to do that.
Yeah.
This sounds super straightforward. Obviously, there are a lot of different stories that a person can write. Where did the idea of actually considering the market come from?
Well, I went down a big, I literally did market research. I went down a Big W and stood in the book section there because Big W is the biggest bookseller in Australia. And they actually, like, people, they slag off Big W and Target and Kmart. But Big W has a really good book section. Mm. And a lot of country towns, it's the only bookstore they will have will be Big W. Like Mudgee, I did the Writers Festival down there. I think they've got a bookstore now. But at the time, that was their only book section. And they do have, like, Jane Austen and George Orwell. But they do have all the romance books and the cookbooks. So that's where I went to do my market research. Because if you're not selling into Big W, you're probably not going to sell enough books to be able to support your family. So you want to sell a book that the buyers at Big W will pick up. Mm-hmm. if you're going to be a professional. Like, most authors are not full-time authors. They have to be an author is their side hustle. So if you're going to be full-time and support your family, you have to take it seriously, like you would any business. Like, if you ran a cake shop, you wouldn't just make Lamingtons because they're your favorite. So yeah, I went down and I did market research, because Nanny Piggins had done very well, but it takes a long time to sort of build up that you're earning enough that you can live off, because royalties, there's a huge lag between when you write and when you actually get paid them. And because it wasn't a page turner, Nanny Piggins was essentially short stories, people weren't sort of like, they'd love the book, but then they'd move on and they weren't driven. Like, Friday Barnes fans will, they'll own all 11 books and they'll be drawn through the series, and they won't wait till it's in the library. They'll have to have it the day it comes out. So that's what I was going for. I wanted to have something that people wanted to buy. And then when the next one comes out, they want to buy it the day it comes out. Mm. Purely for supporting my family and the lifestyle to which I'd like to become accustomed.
You'd like to become accustomed.
Yes. Yes.
Series is an interesting thing. You've written multiple series. Nanny Piggins was a series, short stories, but still a series. So it's Friday.
Yeah, it was just like, I wrote Nanny Piggins just like a sitcom. So each chapter is a separate story, but there is a loose story that goes through the whole book.
Mm. In a book that's a standalone, there's sort of an expectation a character will evolve. Is it different within a series? Do you actually want someone to evolve?
Definitely not with Nanny Piggins, because as I say, it was a sitcom. The characters evolved a bit in The Pesky Kids, and the story certainly evolved. Like, when I came up with the concept for The Pesky Kids, I always had a 5-book arc, and I knew it was going to end after 5 books. Because if you've ever read them, that there was a big story arc, and it all comes to fruition. It's not like random at all. It's like with Nanny Piggins, I did have an idea, if I ever got to finish the series, what I could do for the last story. But that's not the same as working towards that point through the whole thing. Like, if you ever read The Pesky Kids, it all works in a parabola to the final point. Friday Barnes, there is a pressure for her to evolve a bit, and everyone's obsessed with Ian and Friday, so there's a pressure for that to evolve. But the problem is, because they're page turners, the next book always starts like the day of the last book, so you haven't got a lot of time to work with. So like, the first book of Friday Barnes, she's 11, and I think by the end she's 12, maybe 13, and so she hasn't really aged much. Whereas she's been through all this stuff. Like, if anybody been through all the amount of things she went through in those 8 books, they'd be in therapy forever. So, yeah, there's a tension between the timeline and her evolving. But I do think she has evolved quite a bit. But, yeah, you don't really want – like, Sherlock Holmes never evolves or grows.
That's true.
Yeah.
Speaking of Sherlock Holmes, a comment that you made about clues is that clues can be very simple, but an explanation might be very complex. So there's a Sherlock Holmes story about a dog that didn't bark. And you said, I often find myself staring at something as simple as fallen autumn leaves and thinking up sinister complications. Can you elaborate on this idea of simplicity on the surface within a mystery and this elaborateness that sits underneath?
I'm going to have to try and think of an example now. Okay, well, the classic example, the story I read the most when I go to schools, is the story of the missing homework. And that's like I was talking earlier, where the things that really like get a kid to turn cold with fear can be quite simple. And one of them is they have a teacher who you're terrified of and you haven't got your homework. So I was thinking, well, that's what I want to drive a story, just that fear of like having no homework to hand in. And then I thought, well, how can I make that a mystery story? And then, of course, the classic with kids is a dog ate my homework. And I thought, well, that would be a really funny end point, that we discover the solution to the mystery is a dog ate this kid's homework. So having decided that's the end point, and you figured out the motivation, you know, what the tension is, then you think, well, how can I get to that end point in a way that's intriguing for the reader? And it's like, how would you discover that a dog ate someone's homework? And then I started thinking about like what you can test for scientifically. And obviously you could test a poo to see if there's paper in there. So I thought, well, so I started working backwards like that. So it was quite a simple thing, you know, it's going to end up, she finds a dog poo, she sends it to be chemically tested and there's paper in it. So therefore, but you, so you have to start at the other end, you know, like he's, you start with a problem. Oh, Freda, you got to help me. I've lost my homework. And Mr. Spencer hates me. Why does he hate you? And then you go to his room and you look around the room and you see all the things in his room. And then you, you know, you look out the window and it's what you see at the window. And it's like, there's a cricket pitch, but there's also a dog. And it's, and then, so that, yeah, you, you end up with quite a simple endpoint, but then you sort of like, it's like you're raking over the footprints in the sand so people can't see how you get to that endpoint straight away.
It's, there's logic to it, isn't
it? Yeah.
Like A takes you to B takes you to C.
It's weird when you write, like when I write a Friday Barnes book, because I know what's happening and I know what the solution is, it's actually, you're writing it and thinking, this is so stupid. And you don't, because there's no magic in it for you because you know the solution. And you think, oh God, this is so facile, the children are, but to the reader they're like, what happens next? And you've got to remind yourself, just plow through, because they don't know what's happening yet.
It's surprising too. I, Rachel, I took my kids to an event of yours earlier this year. I said this off air. It was so fun, so incredible. What do you think about when you are putting on an event? Is there a formula for it? What makes it good?
Well, I've only just started doing that type of event where I hire a theatre and I do an event that way. So I was so excited. I've been meaning to do that for like literally years. I did because I did this big Christmas show in Sydney in December, and that's the thing I've been wanting to do for 10 years, where I hire a theatre and I have all the theatrical lighting and I learn some songs and I did a big show. And it went really well. I'd literally been planning that for 10 years since I'd done a similar thing for the kids who in the Blue Mountains, after they'd had bushfires up there, they were all very shaken up because they'd been, the fires had come very close to their school. So I'd had that in my mind that I wanted to do that, because when you go to, the thing is, when we, a lot of the, most of the events the authors do, they have no control over. Like you get invited to festivals and you don't really know, like they don't really explain what you're going to do until you get there. And you don't know how many people you're going to be talking to or how old they are or whether they're private school or public school, or you don't know anything about who you're going to be talking to, usually until you walk out on the stage and you look them in the eye. And sometimes you'll expect a big crowd and there'll be 20 kids who don't know who you are and they're not impressed and they talk through when you're talking. And then sometimes you'll go and you'll do like the Sydney Town Hall and there'll be 2,000 kids screaming with delight and laughing at every joke you make. So you have both extremes, and also there's so little money in being an author, and you start to think, there must be some way I can get this bigger crowd and monetize it and make it more effective, both in terms of me being able to put on an event where I'm happy with, because oftentimes they'll get you to turn up and then they'll try and make you talk about something that you're not really equipped to talk about. You think, if I had creative control and just like organizational control, I would be able to put on a better event and entertain more people, and it would work financially. So that's why I started to do the one you went to, where I hired the theaterette in Melbourne. That wasn't really a money-making thing. I just wanted to get, because I knew that I had this big fan base who had not seen me in years because of COVID, and I just wanted to get as many people to come and see me in the day so that I didn't get those emails the next week of, we missed out on tickets. So I thought, I just wanted to do something big. So I hired the theaterette and it sold out, and then I said, okay, we'll put on two shows. And so that's how I came to do that, just so I'd have creative control, because oftentimes you go on stage and the person who introduces you does a really bad introduction. And it's not their fault. They've often organized the whole festival and they've worked so hard. Like, they deserve to be able to be the person who stands in front of the crowd and gives the introduction. But in terms of putting on a show, it's really good to have a good introduction. And at the show you went to, my husband did an audio sketch. And if you have it, like, it's like you have a warm-up guide, a stand-up show. It's important the introduction has energy and hits the right tone. So all these things, and like the lighting and having a microphone that works, you've got no idea how many times when authors do presentations, like the ratio of times the microphone doesn't work or stops working at the worst possible moment. So all those things, I wanted to make sure the microphone worked, the lights worked. I had a really good introduction. And so that's why I've started doing it that way. It's just like, so kids don't go away going, oh, I didn't think much of that. They're like, they're wowed. Like, it was still just me telling a story, but everything was just so. The sound was good, the lighting was good, the introduction was good, and I could just focus on telling a good story without having to worry about all that other stuff.
And you sort of alluded to this already, you have some pretty hardcore fans.
Yes, I do.
The level of fan intensity was decent. What is the nicest thing that a fan has ever done for you?
I don't know. It's kind of weird. When people write you fan mail and stuff and you think, oh, that's really nice, but it's actually, for me, it feels like pressure. I'm under so much pressure to write all these books and to make them a certain standard. Like, it's really like a huge stress in my life, just the sheer volume of pressure I have from thousands of people expecting me to just every year write another book of equal quality. So when I get fan mails like, you're my favorite author, I love you so much, I love you so, like, it's really nice and they mean really well, and I, you know, I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for my fans, without whom I wouldn't have this they finance my life. But it just feels like another weight of pressure every single, it's hard, it's very hard. But I'm very grateful to fans that I can have this job. I think that's the main thing. But yeah, sometimes people send me things, or, you know, like, I've got a coffee page. Sometimes someone once bought me $100 worth of coffees on my coffee page. And like, every single person, I love the coffee page. I know it's weird because it's basically like busking and people just sending me little bits of money. But everybody who sends me, like, because you can buy me a $4 coffee. And every week I get like 3 or 4 cups of coffee from different people, and they'll send a little note about, you know, I'm in Minnesota and we've been in COVID lockdown and the stories have meant so much to my kids because they've been stressed and they haven't been able to sleep, but they listen to your stories before they go to bed at night. It's made a big difference. So that's what I probably love the most. There's little messages and people going into trouble of just like, yeah, here's $4, buy yourself a cup of coffee. And you get these messages from all around the world and you get this insight into people's lives. And because, you know, because it's not the most lucrative job, so it's just nice to know that you're having a positive impact on the world. Like, so that's probably the thing that's I value the most, is like those little messages that just reminding me, yeah, I'm above and beyond the money. Like, I'm making a difference in people's lives in a really personal, intimate way, and that's really, really cool.
The podcast must be very connected to that, Bedtime Stories with R.S. Brett, which I've mentioned on this show before, because I think there is, you know, some kids will read their own books, some kids will have parents read to them, which is lovely, but as a parent you don't always have time to do it. So the act of having someone like the author read their work to your child is pretty special.
Podcasting, 'cause they're like whispering into their ears as well, and the aim with the stories on the podcast, I mean, sometimes I just read The Pesky Kids just to give myself a break. I'll just read a book that I've already written. But most of them, the idea is to have a reassuring story with a beginning, middle, and end, because psychologically that's what I think is the best for children, is to have like a cathartic story with a beginning, middle, and end, because that is reassuring to them that there is order in the world, that whatever you go through, however hard it is, it'll work itself out. That's the reason kids like stories. That's the reason we tell them at bedtimes, because there's something very comforting about them for children. So I'm very, very mindful. I started doing the podcast at the beginning of COVID. That, to me, that's the main function of the podcast. It's like, you have all these exciting adventures and I teach them all this stuff about ancient Greece and King Arthur and Galileo, all these ideas, and it's full of ideas and Nanny Piggins antics. But at the end of the day, I'm writing stories that are comforting, and they're about, like, usually told by Nanny Piggins with her super insightful optimism and bravery, and it all works out in the end, and then you can all go to bed, you know? So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, it works.
Yeah. Well, I get all these really sweet, sweet messages from people all around the world, because it was so, people forget, like, because adults are caught up in what they're going through. It was so frightening for children to see all their grown-ups frightened or having no idea what's coming next. I remember my kids, when we went to lockdown, saying, when are we going back to school? And me having to say, well, it could be a month, it could be 6 months, it could be 18 months, I don't know. And like, for them to have their grown-ups, none of them knowing what's going on, it's like fundamentally frightening. And some of my fans in America, they had all that going on, and they had the Black Lives Matters riots going on. And you forget, those riots went for weeks in some cities. Every night, there's cities, there were riots in the street. And you think, yeah, you would want your kid to plug into a podcast and listen to a silly story by a talking pig. And that's the context of that.
Rachel, we have a lot of writers that listen to this podcast, and we always like getting advice from authors. What is either the best or conversely the worst advice you have for other writers?
I always say, you know, advice is overrated. Like, you've got to have the story in your soul and tell your own story. I would be really, really careful of giving your work to other people to read, particularly your family members. I mean, maybe it's just me because I'm English and my family are English. Like, I've lived in Australia since I was two, but they've got that Protestant middle-class English small-town mentality where they will never praise anything and they will find something to find fault with in anything. And it's like, I would never, like, if I gave my mom my first book to read and all she did was go through it and put a line through all the spelling mistakes, and she knows I'm really bad at spelling. And she'd say, and I said, do you think I'll get it published? She's like, I don't think so. Do you know how hard it is to get a book published? And I'd be like, yeah, but I've been a professional writer for 10 years, which would indicate I have a great deal of talent. She's like, And like, that is crushing. So I would advise, just don't show it to anyone. Write your book, check it, and then send it to a publisher, because people are wrong and they don't know, unless they're a professional or they're like a kindred spirit, they don't necessarily know. Like, all these people, you can pay people to give you editorial notes. You can go to workshops and you can have reading groups. And no one ever in a reading group is going to go through your thing and say, I think this is great, don't change a thing. They'll always find something to nitpick over. And who's to say they know what they're talking about? I mean, I don't even think my publisher knows what they're talking about. I don't even take their advice on board half the time. So, Just tell your story. You know, like, you know, I don't know what your grandmother was like, but if my grandmother, if I had interrupted her when I was telling a story, she would have slapped me. So that's what writing a book should be like. You write your story, you send it in, and they should just say, yes, I'm publishing that. Basically, don't listen to anyone, including me, because look at me. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Final question. Mm. What is your favourite novel by a debut author? Sorry, favourite book by a debut author?
yeah, because you sent me an email saying to think about this. And I was thinking, when is my last? I wouldn't even know if it was a book by a debut author, because I read a lot of stuff for research. I've got no idea. Then I thought, who do I know who's a debut author who I really like? And then I thought, my husband wrote a book. I'll recommend that. So he wrote a book called Senior Moments, because he's actually a playwright. So he had a theatre show called Senior Moments, because obviously we both worked in TV for years. And when he moved out of TV, he moved into the theatre, because he had this idea that he went to the theatre and he saw, like, he was seeing like a David Mamet play or something. And he looked, like, it was all the subscribers, and he looked out at the audience. There's all these people with white hair. It's all older people. But the plays and the plays that they put on are all the cutting edge artistic plays. And they were all full of swearing. And he said every time that one of the actors swore, everyone in the audience like flinched, because they didn't want to hear that. They wanted to see like the importance of being earnest, or, you know, something nice. And so he thought, I'm going to write plays for this target market. So he wrote this sort of sketch show called Senior Moments. And he had Max Gillies and John Wood and Benita from Play School, and it was a huge hit, and it ran for years, and then COVID sort of knocked it over now. But so he wrote a book. He was asked to write a book, but having done that series, that was also called Senior Moments. So that was his book. It came out like 2 or 3 years ago now, and it did pretty well, and it, you know, like, did very well. So yeah, I recommend that, Senior Moments. Great. Particularly if you know an older person who, if they had their natural hair color, it would be white. Buy it for them. It's a great gift. It's very funny.
Thank you, R.A. Spratt, for being on the First Time Podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.